This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 30th of March, 2016, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, are terrorists not nations the real nuclear threat of the future? Barack Obama gathers world leaders in Washington in an attempt to reduce the danger of nuclear weapons falling into the hands of extremist groups. And as India's Tata Steel announces it will pull out of the UK, we'll ask whether nations should do more to protect their homegrown industries and whether that's even possible in an era of globalisation. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Andrew Tuck, editor of Monocle, Tyler Brulé, editor-in-chief, and a very warm welcome for the first time to Midori House to Lisa Markwell, I have to sadly say former editor of The Independent on Sunday, because The Independent on Sunday is no more. Before we start with today's programme, Lisa, The Independent on Sunday has now sailed away.
It has.
Into the past. But it went out with quite a bang.
It did go out with a bang. I mean, we should point out that independent journalism, with a capital I, continues with the Independent app and website. So all of those experts, which some of your listeners might know, like Robert Fisk and Patrick Coburn, will continue online. But the actual print product, which for sort of people like me who grew up with a Sunday paper, will no longer be there. And that's quite sad, not only for us journalists, but also for the sort of discourse, you know, the political discourse in Britain, because there are more right-wing papers than left-wing papers. And so to lose one of those voices in a year, we've got the EU referendum, we've got the American election coming up, it's quite sad that that presence won't be there anymore.
And it's a difficult time for journalism generally, not just in the UK, but around the world. We've recently heard of, Al Jazeera America's closed down, Al Jazeera itself is losing some jobs. We've seen job cuts announced at the Guardian as well, more than 100 editorial jobs there.
Yeah, and I believe that El País is potentially going digital, so it is definitely, there is a groundswell of change. I mean, in Britain, and this will affect a lot of other publications around the world, The Independent has often, you know, the expression is condemned to innovate. We've, you know, there's been the innovation of going digital only as a newspaper. Others will follow. It's just how quickly.
And are you optimistic at the state of the media, certainly in the UK at the moment, or is that quite difficult to look at the moment?
Well, I'm only in my first week of sort of not being the editor of a newspaper, and I have very mixed feelings, because my goodness, the idea of not having to work for 16 hours on a Saturday is quite thrilling. But I mean, I do feel slightly anxious that the self-selection that goes on when you choose your news online. So you will search the items that you think are interesting to you. Of course, if you have a print product, you turn the pages, even if you're just looking for the Arsenal results or the crossword, you may come across a story which you don't know about and you will learn something. And I think that's what newspapers are very exciting for. But having said that, you know, some of the slightly more specialist publications and the weekly news titles are doing very well, and actually they're going up. You know, The Spectator, The New Statesman, The Economist are doing really well. So I think it's probably a time of huge change, sadly quite a lot of job losses, but some titles will continue. It's just identifying their exact audience and speaking directly to them.
And it's also interesting when you look at, you know, the publications that exist right now, not just in paper form but digital as well, whether that is, you know, ourselves here at Monocle, or whether that's BuzzFeed or Vice or many others that didn't exist 10 years ago and that now are hiring people all the time.
That's right. BuzzFeed particularly is spending a lot of money hiring long-form journalists. You know, it's not just about sort of lists about cats that look like Hitler or whatever. You know, it really is, they are investing in proper journalism, and that's exciting. And also, I mean, the next thing that will happen is we're so used to doing previews and reviews of what's in the papers. That's going to be, suddenly there are going to be iPads on the desks, and on television you're going to see people discussing what's on the websites rather than just what's in the printed forum.
Okay. Well, Welcome, Lisa. The independence loss is our gain. We're going to start today by looking at the issue of steel here in the UK. The Indian firm Tata Steel is planning to axe up to 40,000 jobs in the UK. Unsurprisingly, this has upset a good number of people. But the issues range from concerns of communities built around around one industry to what Tata Steel's pullout will mean for the UK's image. It is, of course, the birthplace of the modern steel industry. Lisa, Tata's saying that the UK is too expensive a place to do business, and that when they look at places like China, where they're pumping out steel at a much cheaper rate, it's simply not economic to do to produce steel in the UK. And they have a point, don't they?
They do have a point. I mean, the EU feel very strongly about this predatory pricing and steel that has flooded the market from Russia and China, and are trying to protect what is, as you say, the birthplace of steel, particularly Britain. But the problem is what doesn't always happen, which is that demand drops off for a product or an industry or something. Here, it's not about a lack of desire for steel product and its products. It's that there's this global glut of steel. And so it's a buyer's market, and it's a very, very sad situation. But Tata, I mean, they're losing something like £300 million a year on this. So it's almost £1 million a day with their Port Talbot plant. So, you know, you can't, of course it's not economic to continue under those circumstances. The big question is, now that politics, in the politicians have to wade in, what's the bigger picture going to be?
And of course, there's an issue then for the government, not just here in the UK, but when you look at similar situations across Europe, to decide whether they want to step in the short term and ensure that, you know, there is at least, some sort of buffer to wait for a sale, or whether, you know, you have to actually, you know, decide that, you know, you're just going to let these industries go to the wall.
Yeah. I mean, industry in Britain, the foundation industries, have gone down by 43% since the turn of the century. So in the last 16 years, actual things like steel production, chemicals, has gone down 43%. So it's nearly 50% drop. So, yeah, you know, you worry about an enormous swathe of industry. But the EU, I believe, can't really intervene until, I mean, if you're talking about specific private companies, they can't intervene until they stop trading. And so we're in this very awkward situation where now politicians are trying to sort of score points against each other to say we must save steel. But is that the right answer?
And Tyler, perhaps if I can begin with you. As Lisa points out, this is a company that is losing almost £1 million a day. It's not a charity. You know, there are strong economic reasons why it must decide that this doesn't go forward. But how does a government that doesn't want to see a community die deal with something like this?
Well, it's multifold, and I think that you can probably look at many corners of the world. If I was an advisor right now, I would probably be spending a little bit of time in what was the former steel belt of the United States. And so I think you have to look at steps. You know, let's take an example like a Pittsburgh. It took a very, very long time. So I think, you know, first step is, you know, there is going to be a challenging road ahead. It is not going to be rosy, first months, even first years out of the block. But I think what you have to demonstrate to a community is that you have a plan. Because, you know, as you said, they are going to up sticks. They're out of there. There is a reality. But I think that's where the government does need to be on something of a front foot to say that we have a vision for this. And I think that's actually something though, which has been lacking in many corners of this country, unfortunately.
Andrew, when you look at examples across Europe, other governments have been more willing to step in when private companies have stepped out to at least protect their industries that they feel are important to them in the short term, haven't they?
Well, I think the French, for example, are very clear that there are certain industries that you need to keep going because they're part of your national brand. And I guess the interesting thing here is that for the UK, what they're saying is partly we may step in at this moment to help, even though I'm sure many jobs would even then be lost because of this huge dip in, you know, the cost of resources, the cost of raw materials. There does feel to be in many markets a kind of a breathing space that's needed. Lisa, I don't you feel that there's, it just does feel like a kind of strange moment in a way, because, you know, you're seeing this in Australia with the kind of collapse of the resources boom there. You know, many things just diminishing. This is the same with oil sands in Canada. Many of these trades that we've covered in depth, it just feels that this in a way, is a point where you do need to buy some time to see what happens.
But what's interesting, I think, for a lot of people in this country, and it probably plays out actually in the States and elsewhere, is that for those people who are going to lose their livelihoods, and for a great number of other citizens, they say, well, the government bailed out the banks, which was a huge, you know, it was a huge deal, and it cost every single taxpayer an enormous amount of money. Now, of course, there were compelling reasons for that, and we couldn't just let them go to the wall. But so here we are a little bit later on. This government came to power only a few months ago. One of their slogans was, "We are the builders." You know, they wanted Britain to be a building society again, a country that manufactured back to its glory days. So they bailed out the banks. They're not willing to bail out one of our sort of core industries. So a lot of people are asking, you know, why is that the case? I mean, I think the economic reasons are there, but, you know, you can't pick and choose if you are the government who says that we've got to put our country back on its feet.
No, I think in the end, that's why they, you know, it's interesting for them as well that they have such a kind of a PR issue at the moment, you know, on all sorts of fronts. You don't want that to be the reason that kind of guides their economic planning, but you do feel that they may feel that if they don't do something at this point that seemed to be helpful, that their kind of image of their government will be tarnished in a way that is almost unrecoverable from.
Yeah, and the leader of the opposition has already today come back from his Easter holiday early and called on the Prime Minister to come back from his Easter holiday early to deal with this. And a petition, I believe, has been started today, which already has 16,000 signatures, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for a country in which voter apathy is enormous, you know, there is a groundswell of opinion, and the government, if they want to save face and they want to continue with the slogan, have got to do something.
Tyler, if this had happened 10 years ago, in any country really, you may well have seen politicians saying, well, look, this is globalisation and we're just going to have to get used to this. These jobs are going, but don't worry, there are new jobs. We need to be more competitive and then we'll get new, better, higher paid jobs. But since the financial crash, and also since this rise of populism that we've seen in different forms, but in different countries, that's a far harder sell for a politician now, even if economically they think that's true.
Absolutely. And I think also part of it, just listening to both Lisa and Andrew, is also the narrative. I also wonder if the government sort of feels, yes, that they came out, you know, on this platform in the elections saying, yes, you know, we want to make things, we want to be known for industry again. You know, Britain is truly great. You know, all of the slogans that we saw around the world. But somehow we're still left with the hangover of the surface narrative. Therefore, this was something we inherited. This was already a problem that was there. And I think they can almost throw that off. So, you know, we heard, of course, through the Blair years, you know, we're going to be a service-based economy. That's what we're going to do. And then something like Tata comes along. Well, it was already kind of bubbling away anyway. So maybe it's bolted. It's not part of, you know, let's say the new regime of what building Britain has to look like. I think that, you know, as part of that, you know, as well, if you look at, I think, where the government sits today, they're going to have to, I think, be very decisive in their reasoning as well. Why are we not going to go and write a check for this? And then, of course, what are the ramifications if we don't?
I guess the other interesting thing is, you know, that why this is so different from many years ago is that the narrative of what the unions would do has changed so much. Because what's interesting, when the delegation went to India to meet with Tata, they were going with a plan to allow, in effect, several hundred jobs to be let go to make this a leaner, meaner company. The local MP, Stephen Kinnock, had gone as well, and it was, you know, clear that there was room for manoeuvre. This wasn't kind of the old day industrial. So
this wasn't everyone going on strike saying we must keep our jobs.
And you can't engineer a group of people and a community into a place where saying, you know, you've got to be the flexible ones, you've got to be the modern ones, and then walk away from them. And I think that's why also, hopefully, there will be a bit of a narrative for change. I was just going to say, Lisa, you touched on, and Stephen touched on a good point as well, which I wonder if, you know, this does, bizarrely, a couple of days ago, we were sitting here talking about, you know, the US election, Trump, and the idea of, like, you know, we won't let China take our jobs, we won't, you know. There are these pockets of populism where amongst MPs and politicians who would never sit around a table and get on comfortably together. But there does seem to be some realization about this kind of globalization that it's not always very enjoyable to experience unless you're kind of, you know, as you say, in the world of banking where you know you'll get bailed out.
Tyler, do you think that you know, we've been talking a lot recently about nations. We've got a book coming out in two or three times about how to make a nation. If steel is an integral part of what makes your country what it is, and yet you don't think it's economically viable, what should you be doing then as a government?
Well, we should be charging anyone listening to this radio program a lot of money if we had all of the answers. there's a huge reputational issue. And just before that, I was thinking today, being at Heathrow, I think one of the problems, and you look at two things. You look at Brand UK. You also look at Brand Tata as well. I think they're going to have a big PR problem on their hand. You come into this country, and of course, great history of steel, and still sort of some remnants in some corners. But then you get on a steel train hurtling into the center of London, and that train is actually brought to you by Tata. Now it's Tata's cloud solutions, but I think it's going to be things like this that are also going to really annoy people up and down the country. How is it that you have all kinds, and people, they're not going to distinguish it. It's a big conglomerate. It all sort of trickles up to the same place. And yet you're spending a lot of money to go and sponsor or advertise, on a bunch of rail vehicles. But somehow you've decided to close a steel factory. So I think also, government going out to Delhi as well, was there a discussion about, how can we mitigate this somehow? What else could we do in this country? If we're talking up a good game about Silicon Roundabouts and all of that, maybe we should look at, where other jobs, could occur elsewhere in the country, and particularly up in the region, not just bringing jobs down to London.
And also, just finally on this point, Lisa, there is this issue then of how a government uses its relationships with other countries. So when the Chinese president was in the UK last year, that was at the same time as the jobs were going in the steel industry in Redcar, and one of the reasons given was of Chinese steel, and yet David Cameron didn't seem to have much influence on Xi Jinping there. He's met Modi a couple of times. He's welcomed him here to London with a big event at Wembley. Again, we haven't heard that he's on the phone to Modi to ask him to put a bit of pressure on a company in India. How much do you think these relationships, which governments can build up with each other, actually matter at a moment like this?
Well, I think there's a world of difference between the sort of state banquets that you see when those people come to Britain, and then when you get down to the nitty-gritty. And it's interesting that Cameron has thus far been fairly distant from this and has been putting out Anna Soubry, who's the business minister, to talk about this and explain, yes, we will do what we can, but obviously this is an ongoing situation, because this is a person who, he's in the sort of legacy period of his prime ministership, and he probably doesn't want to get too closely involved with this.
Okay, we'll take a short break. When we return, Lisa, Andrew and Tyler will still be with us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Hello. Have we been introduced properly? We should get to know each other a bit better. We're Monocle 24, the radio station brought to you from the makers of Monocle magazine, the global print title that was launched in 2007 to deliver a briefing on everything from affairs to design. Headquartered in London, Monocle has built up a network of bureaux in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, Istanbul, New York, and Toronto. And we also run our own stores and cafes, where you can get a good coffee, a nice cake, and a copy of the magazine, too. Then there's Monocle.com, where you can listen to this radio station and all our archived shows, watch the films made by our film team, and visit our e-commerce store. Intrigued? I just knew we'd get along.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Lisa Markwell, Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. Tomorrow, President Barack Obama will gather world leaders in Washington for the Nuclear Security Summit, a biennial event aimed at keeping tabs on the global nuclear arsenal and pretty much focusing on ways to avoid future nuclear Armageddon. Good luck to them all. For the first time, the Nuclear Security Summit will include a special session on responding to urban terrorist attacks, and it's a timely conversation to have. Concerns have spiked recently over the likelihood of extremist groups such as ISIS eventually being able to obtain nuclear materials. Lisa Markwell, how serious of a threat is this? Or do you sometimes worry that it's slightly overplayed by some elements in security services to perhaps just sort of heighten fear a little?
I mean, nuclear is a very, very difficult topic. And I think the way you see it is sort of through the prism of your age. You know, if you're a slightly older person, you remember when nuclear was absolutely at the forefront of the biggest threat in the world. You know, you had Greenham Common, you had sort of huge protests, you had things going on. It sort of became slightly less of a hot topic. But nevertheless, Barack Obama, I mean, he really must be congratulated for this being one of his big legacy topics. We were just talking about legacies before the break. One of his has been to try and dial down the nuclear threat. And he has achieved an enormous amount. Very many countries have cut down or completely stopped nuclear production. Nuclear weaponry production. I was reading earlier today that it's the equivalent of 100 nuclear bombs worth of nuclear weaponry has stopped production. So it's a huge deal. But of course, in an era of terror in a way that we didn't ever understand it before, where cells all around the world are operating almost independently of each other, and there's no one place to stop threats like Islamic State, it's of a huge heightened anxiety. And I think this summit, which is Obama's last one, that is going to be, they say it's going to be one of the topics. It's surely got to be the topic, is how to deal with these small factions who are perilously close. I don't want to be a scaremonger, but it feels perilously close to actually getting their hands on these, these nuclear products, which will be used in a terrible way.
Tyler, do you think that this is one of the areas where actually the US has shown pretty good leadership compared to perhaps some other issues around defence and the military where they're perhaps a bit more gung-ho?
Absolutely. And I'm slightly surprised, of course relieved, but it is a little bit surprising that it's actually come onto the agenda so late, because we've been hearing about potential dirty bombs, rogue bombs, centrifuges, things that might go missing, might fall off the back of a truck. I feel like for a decade now. I mean, certainly, since the collapse of what was the former Eastern Bloc, there were always these things. When there were audits done, what was missing, potentially in Poland, what was missing in Belarus, and these stories sort of endure. So it is amazing that it's taken so long. But I think certainly full credit to Washington for putting this top of the agenda. Right now, I think sort of particularly at a time where I think a lot of the international community was looking certainly at media channels last week and thinking, okay, can we really have one more analyst, one more ex-CIA, FBI, NSA person on television, pointing a finger at Europe and how Europe got it so wrong, and the problem that is Belgium, and of course we know there are clearly some security lapses there, but we can't forget that there are security lapses in all corners of the world, no matter how well financed you are, no matter how well wired you are. So I think to be taking a front foot on this is absolutely key.
And I think what's been intriguing following the Brussels attacks, we've had this story which still seems to be not quite substantiated, not quite exactly sure what's happened, but this idea that there was an attempt to kidnap somebody from a nuclear plant, then to potentially set a bomb off. Because in fact, you don't actually need, I don't know how to set a bomb off, but to set a bomb off within the plant, as it were. Because in fact, all you need is a leak, and then you have a huge problem. We've seen in not the result of terrorism. We've seen what happened in Fukushima in Japan after the earthquake there. That suddenly, once you have that, you have like a whole area of country to be kind of depopulated. Now, if that happened in France or it happened in Belgium, then suddenly you have a really huge problem. So you don't actually have to be that clever, and it feels like, to cause a huge scare.
And I guess also part of the problem, Lisa, is that, you know, aside from nuclear power stations, it's there is a lot of stuff out there that we don't necessarily, as Tyler's suggesting, always know where it is.
That's right. Although, I mean, I think Tyler's point is absolutely right, that for a decade we've been hearing about these potential, you know, rogue items sort of falling off the back of lorries. But no one's actually done anything with them. So one just has to hope that they fell off the back of a lorry and into a ditch and were never, you know, now just sort of covered in moss or something. But of course, the countries which are resolutely digging in their heels and will not cut down on their production include, of course, Russia and Pakistan. And, you know, we focus very much on Islamic State, but of course the Taliban are hugely active, as we know with the attacks in Lahore. So that is a real and present danger. And unless they come to the table, it's, you know, I think it is going to be something that we're not going to be able to tie up with a bow at the end of Obama's presidency. Mm. And when we talk about nuclear weaponry, we also bring into that Britain and its Trident program, which, you know, the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, suggested that perhaps we would have the Trident submarines, but without the nuclear warheads on them.
Which so we'll seemed... spend all the money.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's not as mad as it sounds, because as Andrew was saying, you know, if a nuclear device is detonated, then that causes, you know, just the most seismic changes. So, you know, what we need to look at is what weaponry everybody really, you know, it's almost like a sort of brinkmanship. You know, if everyone can just rein back from this, everybody will be safer. But nevertheless, there will still be, you know, deterrence. Mm.
Tyler, Lisa just mentioned the Pakistan. Of course, you know, one big potential threat isn't that necessarily that nuclear weapons find their way into the hands of a terrorist group, but that a state which has nuclear weapons becomes a failed state, and Pakistan is the clear and obvious danger here.
Yeah, I mean, that comes up time and time again. You know, when you hear about the CIA station in Islamabad and what types of cutoff devices they have, not to mention them and others. I mean, you know, this is, you know, always sort of these intelligence rumors, and, you know, and hopefully it's, you know, hopefully it is more than that, because sometimes you think, you know, well and truly, you know, if something goes very, very wrong in Islamabad, you would hope that there's also maybe an extra finger potentially, on the trigger, or at least pulling it away from the trigger anyway.
And Andrew, just finally on this issue, this is one thing where actually America and Russia have over the past few years been working quite well on together, this suggestion that they both need to slightly cut back the number of nuclear weapons they have.
Yes, certainly. The trimming of the arsenals from the peak of the Cold War has been actually quite sizable. But in the end, if you have one, that is all you need to cause, you know, mayhem. And I think, as Lisa said, you know, what's unclear is, you know, we presume Israel has a nuclear bomb. It's not discussed. We know that, you know, North Korea would like to be able to launch something. We've got Iran to step back from brinkmanship. But it feels a very complicated game. But, you know, just to say, it is an amazing thing to see Obama in his last, you know, run of the presidency. He is out to do all sorts of things, and he doesn't seem to kind of be held back by anything now. He's got more ambition, I think, in the last kind of year, 18 months, than we've seen perhaps throughout all of his presidency, in foreign policy particularly.
And also, Tyler, just briefly on that point, this is one of those things where he can just push things through. He doesn't have to rely on Congress to necessarily give him approval.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, legacy has been a bit of a theme in this program already. And part of it is indeed just that. It's great to see that, you know, that energy. And I would say also that type of positive diversion as well from what, of course, is the prevailing narrative, of course, the upcoming election.
We'll end it there. Lisa Markwell, Tyler Brule, Andrew Tuck, thank you all very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilse Vivoris. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We've got music next, then it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli. Do tune in to that at The Daily, of course, at 2200 hours. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.